history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. You may not realize it. You probably have no idea what extraordinary things those seemingly ordinary neighbors of yours have done on our behalf. But we want to ask the right questions and take the time to listen to those stories that will amaze us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We are educated, we're entertained. Often, we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We have the privilege of visiting today with 92-year-old Dan Cano of Santa Maria, California. We're going to hear about his adventures in landing crafts in the Pacific during World War II, including his unexpected interaction with a legendary admiral. But let's start out with your childhood in Texas. Dan, tell us where you're from.
I grew up in Mercedes, Texas. Till I was 16, I went to CC camp and then turned 17 and then I joined the Navy.
Well, what about your childhood? And first of all, where is Mercedes, Texas? Most people probably can't point to that on a map.
Well, that's almost down as far south as you can go on the Mexican border, Rio Grande Valley. I grew up in the country. My dad worked a citrus orchard. I loved it out there because we'd go fishing, we'd go swimming. Always went looking for fruit that was left behind that were too high to get. And I'd be climbing up there, getting oranges, grapefruits, tangerines, whatever it was, you know. Then his boss offered me a job. He said, I want you to go to the dairy and get me 2.5 gallons of milk. And he owned the property where the dairy was at. And I'd walk over there. It must have been about 4 miles. Get up real early, walk over there, walk back, then run home, get something to eat, get my books, and take walk back to school. And ran. I ran like, oh, get out. Everywhere I went, I ran. So in school, I was on the track, and I played football. I lettered in football. But it was like a broomstick. If I didn't have a belt, my pants would fall off. We played football, but it was a battle because we'd played, some towns had a lot of Caucasians on the team. The Mexican people didn't go to school, so they were and didn't participate in sports. Our line in Mercedes was all Mexicans, and we went against those big old farm boys, their cousins calling us dirty Mexicans and bean bandits and whatever. The tackle was Kiko, and I was the end on the right side. And we had blocking assignments, you know. When I opened the holes, so we push him to the right and push him to the left. So when we got on the line and were set, Kiko would spit in the guy's face. And he come charging at you, and they penalize him. And that infuriated him. They block you and knock you down. They step on you. They elbow you, pull you, you know, punch you and whatever. And when we got him down, we did the same thing, you know. So it was a bloody mess.
Yeah, these were pre-face mask days. You guys probably had leather helmets, huh?
Nothing but a thin layer, about a quarter-inch leather. That's all it was.
Kind of like piloting a plywood boat, isn't it?
Yeah, the three-quarter-inch plyboard. But it was a real good life. All family around there. My great-grandparents, Antonio Cano, got a land grant from the King of Spain for his service when they first went to Mexico. He wound up in northern Mexico. They sent him over there to his grandfather, sent him over there to establish a fort and continue on north, you know, exploring. So for their services, they gave him a grant and right on the river. At that time, Texas belonged to Mexico. And we had family on the south side. We had family on the north side. Then when the territory became a territory, we wound up on the north side. My cousins, they wound up on the Mexican side.
So you're growing up in South Texas with that understanding. What kind of ambitions did you have? What were your dreams as a little boy of what you wanted to do or be when you grew up?
Well, when I worked for Mr. Shaw, cleaning the shop, cleaning chicken coop, taking the manure, piling it up out in a vacant place where they use it for fertilizer. I cleaned all around the working area. In the storage room, he subscribed to the first National Geographic magazine. And every year, he would bundle each 12 magazines and put an index on top. So that way, if I want to check out something, I go through the index. Oh, here's the information. He'd go through there. So I asked him, can I read those magazines? So yeah, you can use them, but leave them the same way that I left them. So I'd go in there and I'd get lost going through the National Geographic. So at that time, there was a lot of exploration going on, a lot of territories and all over the place that have not been, nobody been in there, you know, explorers were going in there. And that fantasized me with, at school, I was interested in geography. I wanted to see the world, you know. I was real curious about all these places. I'd see the Jungle Gym movies and all those movies. Heck, I, you know, go out there and explore. That's what I wanted to do, be an explorer. And then one day I came across this National Geographic of the Navy going on a world tour. It had a picture in front of the battleships plowing through the water. And as far as you could see, there were ships out there in the background. It had a caption, you know, Navy goes on a world tour. When they do that, they go on a world tour, we're just showing our might. Say, don't fool with me. Somewhere in the article, I read about join the Navy and see the world. So that fired me up. Says, I'm going to join the Navy and see the world. Then the war broke out. And everybody's leaving. And I was in the 10th grade, and all the older kids and friends, you know, they're all leaving. Homeroom teacher has just graduated and started teaching there at high school. And one morning he walked in, he says, I'm leaving. I'm going in the Army. He was a real good teacher. First assignment in the morning was that you have to get up in front of the class and give a local event or a world event. He says, go to the newspapers, or if you hear something on the radio, you know, tell us about the article. At that time, depression, not everybody could buy a subscription or buy a paper. So my mom used to do laundry for this family. When it was done, I'd take the clothes over to her house. She'd pay me, and then I'd take money back home. She asked me, you like to read the paper? I said, yeah. He says, okay, I'll leave the paper out in the front porch, and you can pick it up in the morning when you go to school, because this is my way to school. So that's what I used to do, pick up the paper. And I had the source to make my current event. Then the other kids didn't have papers, you know. They used the paper, you know, and pick out the articles. And then on Monday morning, I'd get the Sunday edition, had all the comics. And I'd sit down on the swing in the front porch reading the comics. She'd come out, bring me something to drink, tea or whatever. The depression was hard, and everybody was poor, but nobody knew they were poor because we were all in the same boat. And as a kid, you know, nothing bothers you. The adults are the ones to worry where the next meal is going to come from. But us, we thought, you get a job, you get paid. There was no work. People just wandering around. And then in the classroom, all these people were migrating. We'd walk into the classroom, and then the teacher called Roe, and he says, oh, we have Jane here. She just moved into town, and she's going to be in our class. And then the following day, Jane was gone. But Jim was there, a new kid. Every day we had a new kid or two kids. The people migrating, they went to school one day and then they didn't find anything. They just kept on moving.
You mentioned when the war started and guys started signing up, and even your teacher is gone after a while. But do you remember how you heard about what happened December 7th? Did you hear that on the radio? Did you hear about it at school? How did you find out?
We had gone to Mass, and the Mass was over, and we were going back. And then we'd hear, the people have their radios real loud. They're out talking to each other, you know, neighbors talking and everything. Then we went down to, it was a Mexican town, because over there, the whites had their town, we had our town. It was just like we had one big grocery store. There was a superstore. They had everything there. And they had a pharmacy. They had a fountain. We had a theater, restaurants, and barbers, and everything. And then you just go across this track, and there's the Caucasians lived there, and they had their businesses. But we went back and forth. And then the school system, they had a school for the minorities across the track. up to the seventh grade. Then you had to go to the high school. But on the Caucasian side, there was a lot of Mexican people lived there. But you wouldn't find very many white people in Mexican Town.
But so on December 7th, you went to Mexican Town, and then you guys are talking about this. And how did you digest that news? Was it something that you understood right away, or did it take a while for that to sink in?
Well, following the news on the current events, we were covering that, you know, everything was about the war in Europe and what was taking place. So we were well aware of it and knew that they're trying to get the United States into the war. They were divided. They said it's their war. Let them stay over there, because we learned our lesson in the First World War. But politics, we got involved, and then the Japanese got greedy and bombed us. It started the whole thing. And read a lot of articles and stuff that this was all manipulated. God only knows.
Well, whether it was or it wasn't, I'm sure you remember how it made you feel, or what the sentiments were in Mercedes or wherever you went, as far as the response that engendered, or the way people felt about their country being attacked. Do you remember kind of the atmosphere in the days and weeks that followed, what people were talking about, or how you personally felt?
Well, we're talking about the attack. Everybody was worried, and especially the families with kids, you know, of age. They knew that they were going to have to go to war, and they didn't want them to go to war. But at school, all the kids, you know, we were all enthused, you know. We'd hear, so-and-so just left. He joined the Army, he joined the Navy, the Marines, Air Force, whatever. So, you know, you were excited. You wanted to go too, you know. You didn't want to be left alone there in town, you know, when we'd go there where the rest of the kids were going. And I already had been brainwashed with that picture of the Navy. And so if I go, I'm going to go to the Navy. And yeah, but what happens if they sink your ship out in the middle of the ocean? You're going to drown. So I wasn't thinking about that. I just wanted to see the world. But we were well aware of the situation. All this turmoil in Europe started in the late 20s and 30s, and then the depression, and the economy was down, and the people, you know, the families didn't want their sons to go to war. So that was the situation.
But you wanted to, even though you were only 16 years old, you wanted to sign up then, or what?
Oh, yeah. I figured, you know, all we had to do is just walk in and they gave you a gun. But they said, no, you have to be 17 and then your parents have to sign. We stopped at the post office and talked to the recruiter every afternoon after school. So he knew us. He knew how old we were. Same story every day. He said, bring your mom and your dad. I talked to my mom, my dad at dinner, and we talk about it. So-and-so just left. I want to go in the Army. I want to go in the Navy. They said, no, no, no. So my cousin had joined the Triple C's, the Conservation Corps, and he came back from the CC camp after his 6 months. And that was set up to help the people during the Depression, the families. You would go in, and they pay you $30 a month. And then they would send your family $25, and they gave you $5 for incidentals. You had everything. So a hamburger was 10 cents, 5 cents, you find them.
And they had those CCC camps at a lot of places, but the one that you went to work at was in Colorado, is that right?
Colorado. Where we were at, they set up that camp so that we make roads for the mining that was going on. They were looking for uranium. At the time, we didn't know what uranium was or anything, but we'd build the roads for them to get to the mines, and the ones that they had found uranium, they were going in and bringing the material out. And this valley, Paradox Valley, is a big valley. It's just a big hole. Where we were at the CC camp, there was a little store there, the Oil Cattle Ranches, and this little store had everything. There was a post office, grocery store, clothing store, you name it, they had it. And they had a bar. So being underage, and they didn't ask questions out there, so we'd go out there. And first time I got introduced to the Coors Bear. And then we were there for about 4 months or so, and they pull us out and they took us up to the north of Denver by the Wyoming border to the national park that was up there. And we cleaned up after the winter, cleaned up the roads, all the debris and rocks and stuff, you know. And I stayed there till I came home. Put us on a train and we returned home. And then I went back to the recruiter, said, okay, I'm 17. He said, bring your mom and your dad. Same old story. So finally convinced him. So already, you know, already going to the CC camps, you know, I can go in Navy, same thing, you know. So finally my dad says, let him go. And then my mom says, it's going to be your fault something happens to him. I said, okay, whatever. So anyway, I joined November of 42, and then they put me on a train straight to San Diego to the Naval Base training. Went through the training there, and once you finished the boot camp, they sent me to the Strand, where there was a base there, just establishing it, where all the boats were there. And they were, they said, we're going to teach you how to steer a boat. So first time I got, you know, seen a landing craft and operating it. And then they told us, okay, take it in. There was an instructor with you. He'd go in with you. And he says, you're going too fast. Slow down or speed it up. I got to the point that I learned that you ride the wave like a surfer. You gauge your speed up and down till you stay on top of the wave. And then brings you right on in. No effort whatsoever. And then backing out's another thing. Your rudder has to be in the right position when you go out. Otherwise, if you broach your boat, do it sideways, the wave casts you and capsizes you.
And so people understand, you're talking about these Higgins boats, LCVPs.
Yeah.
So it's not the biggest thing in the world.
No, well, we had the LCMs, the tank boats.
You worked with those too?
No. I was strictly the LCVP. I got assigned to that.
And we're going to hear what he did in those LCVPs when we come back. Find photos and a short video of Dan at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 92-year-old Dan Cano of Santa Maria, California. Originally from Mercedes, Texas, he enlisted in the Navy at age 17 and would end up on the USS Zeilen, an attack transport from which he piloted LCVPs in the Pacific. And for some people, that term LCVP may be a little foreign, Dan.
I'm sure they've seen the photos from Normandy. That's what I think most people associate the LCVPs with, and they see the door come down and the troops run out. But for people who've never seen or never been on an LCVP, describe it for us, how big it is, what you have at your disposal, and how you operate it.
Well, it has a gray marine diesel engine, and they're about 35 feet long and a capacity of 32 men to get into the boat. And it will take a Jeep and a Hauser, and all the supplies you can pile in there. You know, you had a certain amount. You watch your water line. You didn't go too far, otherwise you'd sink.
And what is it made out of?
Plywood, 3/4-inch plywood. And we went in on an invasion. They'd handed us a bag of corks, different sizes, to plug the bullet holes. And if you got shrapnel hit the side and it was too big, you had a canvas. The deckhand and the engineer would jump over the side and pull the canvas around and tie it to plug up the hole. Water would seep through, but it wasn't gushing in and keep you from sinking.
So I'm just thinking about when you told your mom, hey, it's no different from the CCC camp. They weren't shooting at you in those camps. And, I mean, if you're going to be protected, really, 3/4 of an inch of plywood is all that's separating you from enemy gunfire?
Yeah, but natural instinct, you duck. Even if it was 1/4 of an inch, you figure it's going to save you. But I learned from an article that I came across on MacArthur. He used to walk up to the front lines, standing up, and his aides and everybody laying on the ground telling, get down, get down. And he'd sit there, survey the whole area, and walk out. And he said, the ones that you hear whistling by, they're gone. So you don't worry about those. The one you worry about is the one you don't hear. Mm-hmm. So then I started sticking my neck out because you got to see where you're going to go because the front end, it's closed. You don't have a view of the area. So I just used to get up and stand there and wait, I guess. I don't know. But I just wanted to make sure I'd get in, unload, and get out. That was the thing.
Well, and you would be part of an invasion that was before what they did at Normandy. This is in November of 1943, and it's a battle that a lot of people don't hear about. But it was every bit as devastating and bloody and important as so many of the other famous Pacific battles. Did you know where you guys were going when you were heading toward Tarawa on the Zeilen, that APA?
No, we took trips. When you pull into Pearl, they refurbish the ship and repair it and whatever, and then they load troops on. And you know you're going for a push, but you don't know where. And then after 2-3 days out at sea, they call everybody into the room. They unveil the map on the wall and said, we're going to Tarawa. Beto, that was the name of the island. Tarawa's the atoll.
And this is not a very big place. It's, I mean, barely shows up on the map. It's so tiny.
Yeah, it's about 1.5 miles long and not even 1/2 mile wide. But the Japanese have been fortifying it since 20 years or something like that, a long time. Their plan was to colonize every island in the Pacific and control the Pacific. Baytia was one of them, and then the biggest one was Truk. They worried about going into that island because there was going to be, it's like going into the mainland of Japan. There was going to be a lot of casualties. That was a fortification. Same way with Tarawa, the commander, he says, if they invade us, it'd take them 100 years to conquer us. So nobody knew where was at. And I found out reading some material that after the war that we did not have any maps or information of the Pacific. So the Navy Department went to National Geographic and borrowed their maps. And that's all we had. We didn't know, we knew who owned them and what nations and so forth, but we didn't know anything about weather, tides, and all of this. And this is what made it real bad in Tarawa. We went in, and they had no idea that when we went there, it was going to be the lowest tide that had ever taken place. And it was over a half a mile, about three-quarters of a mile, miles from the reef to the beach.
They didn't know where the reefs were or how close to the surface those reefs were. They didn't, from what I've heard, they didn't even consider the possibility that landing craft could get hung up on these coral reefs heading into Tarawa, right?
Yeah.
Had you guys been briefed on the potential for coral reefs or anything?
No, we just figured you're just going to go in and land and come out, you know. But this reef was tremendous. And what they had a dock, and that thing was a good mile or more. They had bombed it, and the end had dropped into the water. That's where the boat officer set up his headquarters at the end of the pier. It was at an angle. It was having trouble, you know, standing up on it, you know. And then they started rigging it up so they can hang on to something, you know. But once we found out that about the low tide, and the first time that they came up with an Amtrak because of this encounter with reefs, they made a tank lighter than the tank. The tracks had blades on it, and they would propel the landing vehicle. But the troops had to jump over the top and into the water. And there was about a good 5 feet or better that you jump from the site into the water. And these guys had all their packs and rifles and everything on them. And if they hit a hole, they went straight down like a rock. So started across the reef, and they just became targets because they could pick them off like shooting deals in a carnival.
And this is you know, one of the big lessons learned at Tarawa, as you're illustrating, is that in future invasions, they sent the frogmen in with explosives to take out some of those reefs to make a path for the landing craft to come in. But you guys are flying completely blind to all that when you get there. So for you personally, walk me through how that invasion unfolded, because you're on your APA, but then you've got to load up your LCVP and take a crew of Marines into Tarawa?
Yeah. We were the second wave, and we had about six boats in a wave. The first wave was the Amtraks, and then we were the second wave. We're going to go follow them. And then once we got there, the boat officer, we had a boat officer that was leading the wave. He saw what the problem was, and we couldn't go no further. And they started communicating, hey, we got a problem. And then the Marines are getting slaughtered, the ones that made it to the beach. We were right at the edge of the reef, and you had to keep moving because they were popping you left and right. You were just sitting targets out there.
So you get up to the reef with 30 or so Marines, and machine gun bullets are hitting your LCVP?
No, I was lucky. I never got hit.
But they're sailing over you. You're hearing them, and you're seeing guys die in front of you.
Seeing boats being hit. And then there was a coastal freighter that used to, it belonged to Australia, I think. Yeah, that was an Australian coastal freighter that used to go inner island, you know, running supplies and ferrying people back and forth. When the Japanese taken all these islands, they took over that coastal freighter, and they used it. And then the Navy sunk it about 25 yards away from the pier, at the end of the pier. And the Japanese had set up machine gun nests on the deal. So, and then once we found out that the only way you could get into the beach was alongside the pier, because they dug the reef out there, and there was a channel, and you could go in to the beach, but one boat at a time. So when the first boat went in, the boat officer was in the first boat. He told Johnson, okay, sailor, let's go in. And this book that I have, the boat officer says, that kid says, was pretty brave. He says, standing out there, going into the pier. And then once we got to the pier, the Japanese had been built platforms on the pilings, and they strapped themselves to the piling. And as you came by, they'd start shooting at you. So they call in the Marines and a flamethrower. They put him on Johnson's boat, and he was going through, and they come to the pier, and the guy popped you, the guy shoot him with a flamethrower. And after the battle and everything, Johnson was got a Silver Star, second under the Congressional Medal for his bravery and going in and cleaning that out.
Well, let's talk about your experience. So you take that first crew of Marines in there. You can't get past the reef, right? And do you have a backlog of boats at that point, too, in your way?
Well, yeah, they're all out there waiting. You know, we'd take our turns going in the channel and we'd unloading the troops. So both sides of the channel, our landing on the map, that was Red Beach. And that was our target, Red Beach. So it spread it from the pier, you know, about 100 feet or so. So that was our area to unload, and then the other ones just on down the line. We were supposed to go there, so we started going in on taking turns going in and out of the deal. Then once the tide come in, then we could just go right into the beach. They've been building that thing for 20-some-odd years, and at the very point of the island, if you look at the island from the air, it looks like a bird. And at the top of the head of the bird, they build the bunker. The bombs would bounce off the damn thing. They pile it up with sand and build a bunker, and they build another layer, and then each layer had slits where they could shoot at you. And the planes, you see the bombs just bouncing off the top of the thing. It would not penetrate. So the Marines had to go in there and get to the slits and throw grenades and stuff, work their way up. At the very end, they had an old 8-inch gun that they got from the British or from the First World War. And they had it all ranged in. You could come from any angle, and they could pick you off with that 8-inch gun. So they started hitting us. As soon as we got into range, we started getting hit, shelled by the gun.
So you saw some things that you'd never seen before. What were some of the things that you witnessed there that are still in your memory or in, you know, if you close your eyes, you can still picture them?
It was a carnage. All these Marines that got killed trying to get to the beach off those Amtraks and on the beach, the whole beach was just bodies floating in the water. You could probably walk on those bodies all the way across. There's so many of them. And the beach was same littered. I went in, dumped troops, and they put all the wounded in there. They gave us a box of syringes of morphine. They said, just kill the pain and get them back on the ship, bandage them up. And I had to steer the boat, but the deckhand and the engineer were taking care of them. And they brought this Marine, his face, lower part of his face was blown off. And he had his notebook. He was a sergeant. He had a notebook. He wrote, it said, no morphine for me. It said, wound in the head. He was conscious, still able to communicate. So all we could do is, you know, put bandages on him and get him back to the ship. God only knows what happened to him. We got back, got restored. But the carnage was what we saw, because before, all the killings and dead bodies were on the beach. And at Tarawa, it was on the reef. You go online, you know, and Google Tarawa invasion, and there's pictures there of the bodies laying all over the place.
And those pictures had a powerful effect. You know, we hear a lot about the flag raising at Iwo Jima and what that did for the war bond drives and all that. But before that, they were at Tarawa in 1943, and the photos and even a movie, they made a documentary of that invasion that won an Oscar, but also had the effect of getting Americans' attention of what the fight against the Japanese was going to be like. And certainly that proved true. But you're there witnessing all this, and you're a teenager. You're what, 18 years old and looking at bodies that are mangled and guys that are killed, and you're getting handwritten notes from a Marine who's so brave and so courageous that he doesn't even want morphine with a face that's blown apart. How did you process all of that? How did you keep doing your job in the midst of that horror.
Well, you have to keep on going. You couldn't stop. I mean, you got to save yourself. You know, you got to save everybody. My job on that boat, I was the captain. Nimitz couldn't tell me what to do. He says, just take me to my ship. But Ken said, but before you do this for me. He can tell me that because I'm the captain.
And you're not just saying that figuratively. You actually have a story about that. But how long were you there at Tarawa?
Well, the duration from the invasion till we secured.
So that whole time you're taking trips to and from your APA to drop off Marines and then bring back the Marines who've been chewed up and spit out.
Yeah. And we had to unload every ship, all the supplies that those ships had. We had to unload all the supplies. They were piled up on the beach. And there were people that would remain. I remained behind in Kwajalein to build the base.
Which is how he ended up transporting one very high-ranking passenger. You can find a photo of that incident at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But you'll hear 92-year-old Dan Cano explain it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Dan Cano of Santa Maria, California. He had only finished 10th grade when he joined the Navy at age 17. That wouldn't stop him from a long career as a civil engineer after the war, even participating in the construction of the massive California Aqueduct. But during World War II, he was piloting Higgins boats in the Pacific. You heard about the carnage he witnessed at Tarawa, where 1,700 Americans lost their lives in just 4 days, and more than 2,000 more were wounded. After making another landing at Kwajalein, he remained on land there to help establish a base supporting further assaults.
You stay behind, and they say, okay, this is where we're going to build the boat pool, and this is where we're going to keep the boats and what need to be done. You had to do whatever, carpentry, whatever need to be done, you did it.
And staying behind there saved you from other invasions that guys on your APA had to carry out and deliver troops the same way you had at Tarawa. But tell me about Admiral Nimitz, because I think most people know that name, and even if they don't recognize the source, they probably know his quote about those brave Marines who you were taking to the beaches when he said, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. It sounds like what you're describing from the Marines you saw, they certainly embodied those words of the Admiral.
Oh, yeah. Those Marines, they brainwash them. They're fighters. They're the best.
You saw it. You saw it firsthand. And you also, unknowingly, at least initially, had an encounter with the guy who was in charge, with Admiral Nimitz. We're a couple feet away from a photo of him waving from your LCVP. How'd that happen? Tell me the story.
Well, we went into Kwajalein, and we secured the island. Once we unloaded everything, we went into the inner bay. We got to the big island where the airport airfield was at, and we beached our boats, and everybody walked out of the boats and just dropped in the sand because we've been going at it day and night. And we just laying there, and then I heard a voice asking, it said, "Sailor, can you take me back to the ship?" The guy gave me the F word, And I looked up, and it was an ensign, and I said, oh, my God, he's done for. So he walked up to the other guy and told him, go away, you know. And so I finally got up and said, I'll take you. So, and at the time, I didn't know who it was. So he says, where's your boat? He says, and I took him to the boat. And then he motioned to the deal, and I saw him coming. I said, oh, it's Nimitz. He said, how did he get here? But later on in a book or that I read, he was a very, very smart person. He would go in to the island after the invasion and debrief the people. Regardless if you're an officer or you're a private or whatever, he wanted to know, how would this have been better? How could you make it better for next invasion? And they took all that information. And then is when they decided that by conquering every island was going to be a lot of lives lost. And that's what happened to Truk. We isolated Truk. We took all the little islands around it, and we isolated, and they couldn't be supplied. They either gave up or starved to death, or they committed suicide. But when he came over, you know, he came aboard, and he asked for permission. He said, permission to come aboard, just like I was going aboard, you know, and I told him, permission granted. So I said, okay, son, take me back to the ship. So I took him to the cruiser, and what he's doing there, he's saluting the bridge, because they came over to see the boat coming across, and it was him, you know, so officer of the day and the captain, the admirals up there, they're welcoming him back, and he'd salute him, and that's what looks like he's waving, but he's doing a hand salute.
Yeah, he's either coming up or coming down from the salute, and so the commander of the entire Pacific Fleet asked the 18-year-old kid from the Mexican border if he can come aboard his boat.
Yep, because he knew I was a captain. For one day.
And I'm just looking at this photo, which is actually a freeze frame from a film. So there's the admiral with his helmet on and the star on his collar, of course. And that's you standing up behind him with... Is that no shirt on?
No shirt, no shoes, shorts, no helmet. I think helmet's laying on the engine compartment. On the back of the boat, they had a splashboard. They called it a splashboard. So when you back out of the beach, the waves were breaking, and the water would come into the boat, and it would swamp it. And so they came up with this idea, this splashboard. It was made like a wing out of plywood. So I had seen movies where they they used to call it aquaplane boards, and it had a bridle, and they tied it behind the boat, and you stand on it. And after that came water skis. So I told the guy, says, give me the line. We got the line, and I tied the board, and I dumped it over the side, and it's okay, start it. So they started it, and I was riding the board in back of the boat. That's what he used to do, and we'd take turns. The deckhand and the engineer would and people were laughing and waving. And
you did that at Kwajalein, or why?
Yeah, everywhere there was an invasion. In Kwajalein, we did it. In Tarawa, we didn't, but Kwajalein, and then Philippines, there was too much going on over there.
So you were a water skiing pioneer? Is that what you're telling me?
But it, I guess.
And there's another story with this incident with Admiral Nimitz. I mean, you deliver him back to his flagship, but back in Texas, your cousin is working at a movie theater? And what happened next?
Well, after the battle, RKO was documenting everything. The filming crew was with the admiral, and they were filming him. And this one shot that I got on this video with me in the background, you know, came up. And I knew it was there. So when I came out, I kept looking. I used to go to the movies, the news, and newsreels about the war and all that. Anything that had to do with newsreels, I'd go look at it and see if I could find this shot. But my cousin was working the theater. He was a projectionist. And at that time, you had to reel and rewind every reel, you know, once you showed it. And he was rewinding, and he saw it. Had a frame where he's viewing it, and he saw this figure, and he says, I said, Dan. And he stopped it. And he rewinded up and then looked at it. It's Dan. So we projected on the big screen. He ran out of there, and we lived about a block from the theater and went over to my mom's and told us, I want you to come over here. I want to show you something. And they came and they saw me on the screen. All the people that were in the service, serving in North Africa, Europe, wherever in the world, you know, the Pacific, they knew where they were at. Some of them did, but they knew that I departed from the West Coast, so they figured I'm in the Pacific. And this is when they found out that I was in the Pacific and where I was at, that I was in Kwajalein. And a lot of people didn't know where Kwajalein was at.
What are the odds of that? I mean, what is the probability that, A, you would be in that shot with an admiral, that, B, your cousin would be the one projecting it at the movie theater, and that your parents would be able to come over and see that and in that fashion find out where their son was on the other side of the world? I mean, how crazy is that to imagine?
Well, an act of God. That's all I can think about. Yeah, and I didn't know that. Well, I knew they had taken the film, so when I came out, you know, like I said, I was looking at everything, the photos of the war and everything. Then when TV came around, they had that program, what was it called? Victory at Sea. And they had 1 week they'd give the European, another week they'd give the Pacific. And so I used every Sunday sit down and watch it, and I never saw it. And then about 10 or so years ago, we had moved back to Sanger and walked into Kmart, Walmart, and they had a rack of videos there, World War II videos. They're a dollar. And there was five videos that they had, and they brought the number one, and then next week they brought number two. And so I used to run in the store and search for it, and I got all five of them. And I went through every one of them. And the last one, and it was about ready to finish because the war was coming to an end. That's when I saw that. My wife and I would sit and view that thing, and she was asking questions and stuff, you know, or telling her this, that we were here and all that stuff. And then I jumped up and said, there I am, and I ran to the TV, and I stopped it. I rewinded it back up. And then I got the picture, and I looked at her, and then she said, she kept looking at it. She said, is that you? I said, yeah, it doesn't look like you. I said, no, that's me. So I took the camera and took a picture of the screen, and I called my son and said, hey, I told him what had happened, and he said, send me the video. So I sent him the video, and then being in radio and electronics and everything, he made that copy there. He cleaned it up and everything. And I've been aiming to send a copy to the museum in Fredericksburg.
I think they should have you out there as a special guest. I mean, who else can they bring in who was in a boat with Admiral Nimitz? You think there's anybody else alive who was in a boat with Admiral Nimitz?
Well, his staff.
I doubt they're still around.
Well, I'm around.
Well, what do you think of when you look at that on the wall? What memories does it bring back to you?
Well, where I was at that time, you know, what it was like. The invasion was over. We were at ease. We didn't worry about anything. The only thing we worried about was going from Kwajalein back to Pearl, submarine sickness. But I stayed behind in Kwajalein to build the base there. And then we were there about 4 months, and they took us back to Pearl. We got to Hawaii. They had a camp at the entrance. It was a boat pool, but a personnel pool also. And they used that to replace people that had gotten killed or gotten sick or whatever. They needed people. They line you up and says, you, and you, this way, you, over there. You'd go to wherever they were sending you. So when I came back from Kwajalein and then went to the pool, after about a week, they called us and they loaded us up. And same routine, went out to sea, been out at sea, and they brought out the map, says we're going to the Philippines, going to Leyte. I had heard about the Philippines, but those islands up there, never heard about it, you know. And being interested in geography, I knew Australia, New Zealand. So we went to New Guinea, picked up troops in New Guinea. We spent about a couple of weeks, and then all the ships starts coming in, battleships, and all you could see was nothing but ships from your ship to the horizon. And we went into the Philippines in Leyte. And we landed in Dulag. And MacArthur landed in Palo. And it was about a couple of miles from Tacloban. Otherwise, I would watch the big production. The guys that were there, they said it was unbelievable. He didn't want the boat to land and he walk off on the beach. He had to drop off the boat up to his ankles and get wet. And a real ham.
Well, Dan, we're running short on time here, but there are a couple other things that I want to ask you about. I know you and your wife, Vera, enjoyed your time in Sanger in the Central Valley, and now I know you love the cool air of the Central Coast here in Santa Maria, but how many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids do you have?
I got 3 kids and grandkids, honey.
12.
Great-grandkids? 10?
Well, I'm just thinking. 3 kids, 12 grandkids, 10 great-grandkids. That's 25 people who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive the war. You ever think about that?
Yeah, because my father-in-law used to say, look what I did when all the kids were surrounding them. Look what happened when I came over here.
And you got to go on the honor flight, is that right?
That was fabulous. I recommend that to every vet. It's unbelievable.
What was the best part of it for you?
The police escort that we got in Washington.
You don't know how many veterans tell me that. I mean, I guess it makes you feel pretty special, huh?
Oh, yeah. The look that the people are standing on the sidewalk expecting an ambulance or a fire truck, and they see a bus. God, it's unbelievable. Everybody snapping pictures, and right at peak time, you know, traffic just at a stop, and they're parting for us to go through.
Well, and one of the reasons they do that is because it is important for you guys to be able to get to your memorials. And that World War II memorial has a wall of gold stars. That's representing 406,000 Americans.
I got pictures of those.
Well, what did you think about when you were looking at that? With everything you'd been through and the carnage that you described at Tarawa, are those the things that came to mind as you took that in?
You just go back and reminisce at what took place and thank God to come out without a scratch. Every day, I think, when I get up and bring me this far and bless me with all my children.
You know, most of the people listening to this right now, they weren't alive when all of this was happening. They certainly didn't see what you saw, what you had to deal with as a teenager. For all those Marines that you saw pay the ultimate price at Tarawa, and at other places, how should those men be honored or remembered today?
Every veteran should be honored and given the benefits that they deserve.
Well, there's one thing I want to make sure I say. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that, when you look back on all of this, that you'd say that you're most proud of personally?
Being in the service and serving the country. And I tell this to a lot of people, you know, if it wasn't for all those teenagers, those remaining people that would have survived to get to this point would not be speaking English. Or there would be ashes out in the field for fertilizer, especially if you're a minority.
That's a unique way of expressing it, and it just reminds us what a debt of gratitude we owe to Dan Cano and all of those who have put their lives on the line for us. That's all the time we have today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.